honoring veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler, brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere, on the air and online, by Provident Payments, one of the fastest-growing payment consultants in America. Connect today at providentpayments.com.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and an installment marking National POW/MIA Recognition Day. No one ever plans on becoming a prisoner of war, but for those who do endure that reality, their perspective is forever changed. And in listening to their stories over the years, I know I always hear something that opens my eyes, often revealing things that I take for granted that I really shouldn't. Jerry Gleasing was a young aviator from North Dakota with a pregnant wife back home. His first mission as a B-24 co-pilot included his fellow pilot getting wounded in the cockpit. His second mission became even more of a nightmare.
We were going to Vienna, Austria, to bomb a marshalling yard, and we did. We made it up to Vienna all right, and the flak didn't seem as bad as the day we went into northern Italy, and it's kind of more off in the distance. I looked across at another group of planes that were getting hit a lot harder than we were, and apparently we got hit. I don't know for sure if we got hit, but as we dropped our bombs and as we went into the rally and left, we started losing engines, and we lost an engine, and eventually the prop winds up and ran away on us and had to eventually use the feathering button to get it down. It wouldn't hold. You let go of it a little bit and it'd start winding up again. So if you let them go, they might fly off of there, but if they don't and just engine stops, they'll just sit out there and windmill, and they're a terrible drag that way. So we feathered the engine and it was dead, and the props turned into the wind. So that was the lightest load. And we looked at each other. The rest of them were gone by then. They had left us. We still had engines. We thought we were going to make it home all right. We had three engines.
But all the rest of the planes in your formation are still going full speed. So you're all alone.
You got a little bit lonesome because they were higher than you, and they took off and disappeared. Eventually, we lost three engines. And we to this day, I, of course, don't know what really caused it all. But we did lose them all in the same manner. And got down to one, and we couldn't hold altitude, or we couldn't hold speed or anything. So the pilot gave the order to bail out, and by now we were over hungry, and that's when we all bailed out. And we were still there fussing with it, trying to make it go, and I assumed that all the rest of the crew was gone, and I was getting nervous about the altitude, and he was still working with that thing. And so I finally got out of the seat and hit him on his shoulder, and I said, "Joe, I'm leaving." And I get back to the Bombay, which is just a short distance there, and here's the engineer squatted down, ready to go out of the hole, and the navigator right behind him. And he doesn't go, and he stands back up. So we're screaming at him to go, go, go. So the next time he gets down, the navigator didn't give him a chance to stand back up again. He just got on him and shoved him out through the Bombay. And then he went, and then I went. The rest of the crew was on the ground by then, I'm sure.
You didn't know when or if Joe was going to get out of the plane.
That's another thing that bothered me, because he didn't get out of the seat right away, and as far as I knew, he was still there when I went out the door, and I worried about that for a long time. He did land in Yugoslavia, which was on the other side of the river.
So you are out the Bombay doors, your parachute's deployed, you're floating down toward a place you've never been before, you have no idea what's going to greet you. What's going through your mind as you coast down toward...
Oh, that's the first thing that hit me, was the chute opened up, and I'm still there, and I had this escape bag wrapped around, the handle wrapped around my hand so that I could have something on the ground when I got there, a little food in it, and then a 45 automatic pistol in it. But the first thing that hit me when that chute opened up and I looked down, I thought, oh gosh, I haven't got a friend in the world down there.
And you think about your wife?
Well, at that point I didn't. When I hit the ground and got free of my parachute, and I like to tell that I was not nervous about it at all, I got up and started running, and when I hit the end of the ropes of the parachute, why, it pulled me back on the ground again. So, but I knew what I was doing at all times. Anyway, the next, then I jerked myself out of the parachute and was up, and I hear these guys come out of the woods, you know, and they carrying tools of their trade. So one would have a pick in his hand and another one a shovel and that kind of stuff. And
these are Hungarian civilians.
They are Hungarians. I didn't realize they were Hungarians at the time. I didn't know exactly where we were. And so, in fact, our navigator had told us how far we were from the Russian lines, and that maybe we could make it, but we didn't. Anyway, these guys come running out of there, and I was scared. And so I was running the other way, and I saw the nose gunner. So I ran over to him, and I just thought I was scared. He could not talk. His teeth were chattering. Mm. And I'd heard of people's teeth chattering, but I saw it. And he couldn't do anything, just stand there. So that calmed me down considerably, because I got more concerned about him. But during that period of time of running, from the time I knew I had to try to run away from these people. That's when I daily did the praying, and all I could think about was my wife and the new baby that was coming along. You know, I have no idea anymore how many there were, but I probably a dozen. Here's these guys that you're now at their mercy, and they're standing there asking who you are and that kind of stuff, and you tell them they want to know if you're Amerikansky, and you tell them yes. And I'm looking each one of them in the eye for some reason or other, and I see this one guy in the second row. He was kind of older than the rest of them, and I just thought to myself then, boy, it was just you and I out here. We'd figure out how to get out of this thing, wouldn't we? So I thought I had a friend, but but by then some Hungarian soldiers actually showed up, and so they were in charge, and these other guys just kind of disappeared back to their work, I guess. And so they finally rounded us all up in a truck, actually, and hauled us into town, little town there. We were in a passenger train for a while. I wound up getting interrogated every step of the road, and I didn't know really what they were doing that for, because you could only tell them your name, rank, and serial number, and that's the end of it. And then you try to switch the subject to something else, and they'd get you back. And he knew where I was from, or where my family was from in Germany. They shipped all the Air Force people up to Frankfurt for interrogation. And I thought I was there 9 days, because it seemed like longer than that. Maybe it was less than that. I'm not sure anymore. But it seemed forever. I was in a room, didn't have a window. And the only daylight I had was the crack under the door. I could see the light coming in there. So that way you knew which direction was up. And there was very, very, very little heat in there. Very cold winter. Coldest winter on record yet in Germany. I had a comb in my pocket, and there was a radiator in the room, heat, hot water. And I would take a tooth out of that comb, and I would try to see if I could melt it on that cold radiator. That was one of the things, and it didn't work. But that was one of the things I did. You had nothing. You know, it's dark, and you either lay down, sit up, or stand up. So we did get fed twice a day. And if you had to go to the bathroom, they had a handle out there. You could drop the arm. But without being told, I think if you drop that thing too frequently, then they'd let you out to go to the bathroom. Maybe they'd ignore you. And if it happened to be a time when you really had to go to the bathroom, you didn't want them ignoring you.
Don't want to be the boy who cried wolf.
Yeah.
So. In their interrogations of you, they ever threaten you? They ever scare you, intimidate you?
Even before I got to Frankfurt, I was threatened with going to a concentration camp because, well, I'm not going to do that. I'm in the Army. I got dog tags and all that. Well, anybody can make those, and you can get that Army uniform if they want you over here as a spy or something, which was all a joke, but they just tried to scare you, threaten you with the concentration camp. And at Frankfurt, this guy was asking me questions, and all of a sudden these huge footsteps behind me, and I look around, and here's this guy with a gun, not pointed at me, but with a row of bullets here, I call them bullets, another one here.
Bandoliers over his shoulders?
Bandoliers, that's the right word. So he made you a little nervous, but he didn't do anything. He just stood there, let you know he was in charge, I guess. It was warm, and he had cigarettes, so I'd ask him, where do you get your tobacco? He said, from Turkey. He'd give you a cup of that ersatz coffee, the terrible taste and stuff, but I wasn't even a coffee drinker at that time, but you drank it anyway. Went into one of the bathroom one time, and here was a guy that couldn't get up to the toilet to do what he wanted to do, because his legs were broken.
From his interrogation.
So, no, I don't know how they got broke. Yeah. I assumed it was in combat.
Oh, okay.
But you might be right. But anyway, I held him up to the toilet so he could go to the bathroom. And all of a sudden, the guards realized there was two people in there. And they come charging in there, you know, with the rousemitten, whatever they said. And I guess we were done by that time, because I had to leave him. And nobody had done it. I asked him if anybody was helping him. He says, no. But he says, he was on a plane, because he said, only about three of us survived, or something like that.
And finally, they moved you to a prison camp in Nuremberg, Germany.
Right.
Stalag 13D?
13D. Right? Had Italian prisoners in it. We didn't get moved right in with them. We were in a separate area. There was about 100 people there, 100 soldiers, that were captured in the Battle of the Bulge. They were all enlisted men that were in that camp before. I say 100. I don't know if that was 100 or 200. They were in another barracks. But they were using them to bury people in town. They'd haul them into town to bury people. But anyway, a short time later, all these Italian people that were interned for political reasons, I guess, were moved out. And they left, and the American prisoners of war were moved in. And they cleaned up those barracks, and they had big piles of stuff, and the Germans let them burn it. to clean up. And I guess it was.
And you still had most of your crew with you? All
went
to the same camp?
At this time, you just had Joe and Jackson, a navigator, and myself. And a bombardier that we'd picked up just for that mission.
And Joe was your pilot.
Joe's the pilot.
You didn't know what happened to him, but then he did end
up with
you.
I didn't have him there. That's right. I said I had him there. I didn't have him yet.
But he would show up there.
But he showed up at Nuremberg about probably a week after we got there. And moved right into the barracks that I was in, and so he and I commandeered a bunk there, and we slept together the rest of the winter there.
Try to stay warm in the coldest winter ever. Did that give you some relief to know that he was okay, to see his face again?
A lot of relief. A lot of relief. I was extremely pleased to see him come walking in there.
And you have no idea at this time how long the war is going to rage on, but as we know now, it was within 3 months of the end of the war. And the Germans were very short on supplies. It was hard to get anything anywhere. And these POW camps weren't exactly luxurious accommodations. The food was very sparse.
Yeah, it was. And no Red Cross parcels. We'd heard about them, but we didn't get any. And one time we got one shipment of Red Cross parcels that we divided between six people, which was good, compared to what we'd had before.
And if you get the soup and there's a little maggot in it or something?
One night we had potatoes in that soup, and I looked across at Joe, and I said, we could make it a long time if we had a meal like this every night, But you talk about, I never had any, at that point in time, I never had any thought about not getting out of there. You have complete faith in the United States. They're going to come and get you. Even the short while I was there, I think if you didn't have that kind of faith, you would have gotten a lot worse shape.
It was hard to get. How much weight did you end up losing?
Probably 50 pounds, 40 pounds. I think I was about 140 pounds when I got out. You didn't get weighed for at least a week or more after you got out. But my first weight put me up to 160 pounds, and I was about 190 when I went down. We went from Nuremberg down to Moosburg. Where we marched. I'm sorry. That's where we marched. We had to walk down there. And it took quite a while because I don't think they realized that we were coming. They didn't have any accommodations for us. The place was full. And so we just slept out on the ground when we got there. I was only there a couple of weeks and before the front went through and we were liberated. And then they flew us out of there. Yeah.
And I imagine that felt pretty nice.
Well, the two greatest sights of my life, one of them was the American flag going up on the flagpole in that camp, because then you knew we were in charge.
And this is in Moosburg at Stalag 7A?
7A at Moosburg.
Uh-huh. So they moved you in early April from Nuremberg down to Moosburg.
Yeah, we left Nuremberg April 14th, and we got into Moosburg. April 4th, we got into Moosburg 10 days later.
Uh-huh. And then on the 29th, you see that flag go up. You're liberated, and pretty soon you're going to be going home, and there might be a baby there waiting for you.
And there is. I fully expected that. I didn't know. I knew we had Michael until I got off the plane in New York, or off the boat in New York, and got my way to a pay phone, got some quarters, and called my wife. And first I wanted to know how she was and all that. And she says, "Well, don't you want to know something?" And of course I did. And what do we have? And she says, "We have a girl, Mary Jean." But the other sight was the Statue of Liberty.
I've heard so many veterans say that. Beautiful. What did that mean to you?
It's your home.
That's beautiful. What you were fighting for, huh?
You bet. Beautiful. Yeah.
And I can tell it's still emotional for you now.
It still is, yeah. It probably wasn't then, but it's more now than it was then.
What about when you saw your daughter for the first time?
Well, we got home into Fargo. My wife came and met me came to Fort Snelling and met me in Minneapolis, and we were there a couple days. And then when we got home to Fargo, and she was living in an apartment. An ordinary home had been turned into five apartments. And another lady there took care of her while Nancy was down. And, in fact, her mom had been visiting her just before that. So then this other lady took her. We went to her apartment, and this little baby was laying on the davenport. And she just rose up and looked, and that was the first time I saw my daughter. Yeah.
I imagine that's a pretty unforgettable moment for
you.
Yeah,
it is. It is.
So she was going to be here no matter what. But if you hadn't made it back from Stalag 13D and Stalag 7A and survived the war, how many more Gleasings, how many more children would not have been here if you hadn't made it back?
Well, we had a total of seven, so I guess that's six.
And how many grandkids now?
How many grandkids? About 15.
All right. Incidentally, what?
Well, we were going to have Michael, and we had five boys, total, and Michael didn't make it.
You found seven other names.
They're all something else, yeah.
Absolutely. When you look back on it now, how do you account for what happened to you? Why do you think you got to come home and have seven children and 15 grandchildren in the life that you've had?
I know you start this program by talking about heroes. Well, the heroes, really, most of them didn't come home.
That includes over 400,000 Americans killed in World War II, and also the more than 81,000 from World War II through today's conflicts who remain missing in action. On National POW MIA Recognition Day, we honor and remember them. And we thank those like Al Finley and Jerry Gleasing for sharing their stories so the rest of us have a better understanding of what it means when we utter those four words that close this program each and every week. Freedom is not free.
To let Paul know about a veteran in your life, visit hometownheroesradio.com and click on Suggest a Veteran. Today's program has been brought to you by Provident Payments. Give your business the edge only their personalized service can deliver at providentpayments.com.